Marsh from Saga here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Look, this is going to be a super straightforward intro. Favorite topic, Hollywood, future of entertainment, streaming, movie theaters, China. We've got Eric Schwartzel of the Wall Street Journal on to discuss red carpet, Hollywood, China, and the global battle for cultural supremacy. This is basically the second time we've spoken to someone from the Wall Street Journal about Hollywood streaming. We had Ben Fritz on last winter / early spring, so definitely listen to that episode right afterwards. But Sagar, what did we cover? Why is this interesting? All good stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely love this episode, Marshall. And the reason why is because he is able to show us both the history of Hollywood in China, then tell us a little bit about what happened after the turning points, what they were, then how Hollywood began to kowtow, but then how that kowtowing has actually failed and we are in a new era of Hollywood and Chinese relationships. So pretty much all the takes out there are outdated and wrong. That's what I love about the pod. I get to learn, and I learned a lot during this episode.
Yeah, I just want to actually clarify what Sagar is saying there, because we came into this episode thinking, okay, it's crazy. Tom Cruise, They're taking the Taiwan patch off. How do we stop this? His point is that that's a very 2017, 2018 conversation. Marvel movies basically aren't getting let into China right now. The last two Marvel films that were headlined by a Chinese director, The Eternals, and then a Chinese star, Shang-Chi, literally weren't even let into the country in the first place. So we're in a whole new ball game, and how it goes and where it goes from here is up for grabs. So lots of great stuff here. Quick shout outs, of course, sign up for the Substack. We'll have some great things going out on Thursday. This is a book, so check out our bookshop. All the links are there as well. Of course, you could send us a tip. We've appreciated the people who've sent in the tips. Always good to set little notes of success. And then finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you enjoy the episode. Eric Schwartzel, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We did this whole bit before the episode started where I gave you an incredible amount of praise for the book Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. And I said, I actually read this book 2 weeks before we actually did this conversation. So reading this much into it means that we're going to do a slightly different style of conversation here. This will be a little less of an outline and more just asking questions about a really fascinating topic where, let's just start with this. Sagar and I were completely out of date with the story here, because when we got the notification from your publisher, I thought we were going to spend our time talking about Top Gun and how Hollywood was just in this really winning position. And we were going to ask you questions about, like, what can the federal government to do so Hollywood can't just kowtow to the degree that they are. But as you tell the story, that's a very 2018, 2019 world, entirely different interview, entirely different conversation. So what would you say the world of today is in January, early February 2022, when it comes to the conversation of Hollywood in China?
Today, the word is that Hollywood got played and that China has made it very clear that they do not feel like they need Hollywood anymore. I would say Hollywood is not at a place, though, where they don't need China. And so there's really just a lot of anxiety and, frankly, cynicism in the film industry right now about how they arrived at this place with the Chinese market specifically. I think you're right. I mean, anytime John Cena gets in trouble for implying Taiwan as a country, or this past week there was quite a bit of news around the movie Fight Club being edited for Chinese audiences. Anytime that happens, there's like
this one is really fun. You have to, if audience members did not see this scuffle, please explain what happened with the editing job. This is a very good story.
Yeah, so streaming in China is huge. It's this huge business. There's three major streamers over there, and Tencent is one of them. And they acquired the streaming rights to Fight Club, which is already a very odd movie to get distribution rights to in China. But as many probably remember, that film ends with Edward Norton's character standing and watching the city be demolished. And it's implied that Tyler Durden's anarchist plan has worked and come to fruition. If you are watching this film in China, before the city can be demolished, text appears on screen saying that thanks to a tip, the Chinese police have successfully arrested Tyler and foiled his plan. And this is obviously a very kind of like baldly revisionist look at how that movie ends. But I have to say, this and John Cena and every other flare that goes up in the Hollywood-China relationship has happened for years. People who have been working and releasing movies in China know that you really have to achieve a kind of moral equilibrium when every movie ends. So if there's a bad guy in a Chinese movie, he will always be arrested. The Chinese version of The Silence of the Lambs would not end with Hannibal Lecter escaping tropics, right? Ocean's 11 would end very anticlimactically with George Clooney being let off in handcuffs. Because
I have to say real quick, my favorite joke that I saw on Twitter about this is, I don't know if you saw Licorice Pizza, but they would halfway through the movie, there'd be a black title card saying both characters are 30 years old, the end. And it would basically deal with that part of the ambiguity.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's fascinating because this has been something that Hollywood has been dealing with in some cases publicly, some cases privately for now going on 25 years. It just feels like patience for it among Americans and American consumers is wearing thin.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm fascinated by here is the getting screwed story. Because like you said, I mean, I've been interested in this for a while now. And I've had to update my thinking very recently. I just read a piece in the Ankler about how the Hollywood kind of kowtow to China is actually not paying off, which is we've now seen 4 Disney movies get blocked just this year. A lot of the efforts in order to appease the Chinese Communist Party are still not working commercially, and they're making it clear that they don't necessarily want Hollywood in there. So what happened? I mean, how did this whole story begin? Because even a year ago, if you'd asked me, I'd been like, oh my God, they're taking over our culture. They're making it so that we can't not just criticize them, but we have to edit our own, you know, massive cultural export in order to accommodate their society, which changes our own. What happened in this story in which Hollywood itself got used, essentially?
Well, it might help to start by explaining how a movie gets into China. So let's say we're running a studio or major studio like Universal or Warner Brothers, and we have a movie, let's say it's a superhero movie that cost $150 million to make. That is a movie that we want to get into China because that's a really expensive film and you want to make money globally on it. So you have to submit, once the movie's finalized, you have to submit it to the Ministry of Propaganda in China, and you have to have it approved for release by Chinese censors. Now, the censors are often state bureaucrats, sometimes even film studies professors, and they're watching for several things. There's surface level stuff like excessive violence, nudity, things like that are not going to fly. But then they even will examine a film for more thematic issues, like does this movie celebrate challenging authority, or does this movie present America as the default global superpower? Are there subliminal messages that might be problematic? And if it gets through, as most innocuous superhero movies do, it will be approved for release and distributed in Chinese movie theaters. There's now about 70,000 theaters in China, which is about 20,000 more than in the US. So it can be a real cash cow. However, American studios only receive 25% of ticket sales from China. In the US, on a big movie like that, studios will get about 60%. So one major frustration is that the terms of business in China, according to some critics, are still as though it's a developing market and not as though it's the world's largest box office, which it is. So that, but still, 25% of $300 million in grosses is still a really nice chunk of change. And increasingly, as these movies get more and more expensive, the Avengers of the world get more and more expensive, that can mean the difference between profit and loss. And so getting into China is a huge priority for these big tentpole films. And so basically, it didn't take long for studios to ingest what they needed to do to ensure those releases. And that would mean not only avoiding any scenes that make China look bad in any way. And I'm talking down to the smallest detail. Like there's an example from Mission Impossible 3. There's a scene in which Tom Cruise is running through the streets of Shanghai, and there's laundry drying on clotheslines outside of the buildings that he's running by. And the studio had to edit that out because the Chinese authorities didn't want to give the world the impression that it was the kind of country where people dry their clothes outside. And so over time, the studios ingested this and really at the script stage could make sure there was nothing in these films that was going to be deemed problematic by the Chinese authorities. And frankly, the market just grew too big to ignore. If you are looking at a global market where domestic movie going has flatlined, which it has since 2008, and you have a market in China that is growing double digits year over year, it doesn't exactly take like an MBA to know where you need to put your investment. The reason I say Hollywood got played, though, is because it's very clear from the early days of this relationship that China wanted to build its own film industry and learn from Hollywood and essentially mount a competitor to it. And because the Chinese government controls so much of how you do business there, it's very easy for them to shut off access and there really be no recourse. And so that's where we are right now. The American movies are not getting in, and the Chinese movies essentially have access to all of the ticket sales.
So two things here. One, a story that as a big Marvel fan, I found really interesting was the Russo brothers. I'm not pronouncing that correctly. One of those two is right. Where this is, you know, they choreograph these like incredible fight and action sequences, especially in the Captain America movies. But as you point out, they actually went and helped with Wolf Warrior 2, which is basically the Chinese version of Rambo. And that's an example of how once you've learned that skill set, you don't actually need that. But here's a question that I just don't understand given the history you just told. It seems like if you're China, or the Chinese Communist Party specifically, total victory. You have a massive audience. You've delivered tens of thousands of new screens to your population in a 20-year period. You've successfully conned some of the most, let's just say, self-centered, arrogant, we know what we're doing people of all time. So this is a huge politics aside, just like, good job. Like that's a very like well-executed plan here. You've gotten self-censorship because what's also fascinating in the book, as you point out, and this is the real point of you mentioning the whole at the script level. It's not as if there's a censor sitting over every single script. If you're in Hollywood, you're thinking, is this a little too much? Let's just dial that back. So you've actually enabled meta censorship, which is incredible too. Why would you cut off the market at your period of total control? Wouldn't at a geopolitical level, given how much, when John Cena kowtows and apologizes, it takes over American social media for 2 days. It increases cultural fights. It causes all these problems. Why would you not just keep squeezing and pulling rather than just say, nope, it's over, it's done? That doesn't make any sense to me.
It's really unclear. And also, this is one of the virtues of the system. There's no memo that's released saying this is why we're not letting Hollywood movies in. So everyone's really just having to come up with all of these theories and essentially hoping that the winds change at some point. It does feel like I agree, it might not be great for Chinese business. And I think certainly if you talk to Chinese movie theater owners off the record, they'd say, we really want to show Spider-Man 2. Like, right. You know, right. this is not great for the Chinese economy that they've built of movie going. However, I think under Xi Jinping, we've seen politics trump economics time and time again, and to the point where it doesn't seem like it's helping the cause. I mean, I think we saw this quite a bit also with the controversy around Chloe Zhao with last year's Oscars, where An interview.
Can you explain that? Just explain.
So last year, Chloe Zhao, a director of a Chinese-born director of Nomadland, was the clear front runner to win Best Director and Best Picture at the Oscars. And for a while, Chinese state media responded as we would expect them to. They were trumpeting her everywhere, calling her the pride of China. When an interview that she had given, I think in 2014, with a rather obscure magazine surfaced in which she was critical of China and how growing up in China, I believe she said, was a land with lies everywhere. And this spread throughout Chinese social media, and her sort of lack of allegiance to the country and to the party led to China scrubbing her from the internet, scrubbing her eventual win at the Oscars from the internet, and frankly, just sort of like falling into a situation where doth protest too much, right? Like, more people knew about Chloe Zhao's comments in 2014 than ever would have had that situation not exploded with some government support. Now, you could say also Chloe Zhao became a very public cautionary tale that once again reiterated that you can't venture into these places. But I thought that was interesting because here's a chance for China to have a Chinese board director standing on the Oscar stage with two statues in her hand and imagining the soft power that could come when the People's Daily gets their hands on that photo. And instead they said, politics is not going to trump that kind of world stage or that kind of presence that we could have.
And just one quick thing, Chloe Zhao then went on to direct The Eternals,
right?
Yeah. The next big Marvel movie. So the case is even a little more aggressive than you're putting it, which is that you have a person who's able to do the artsy, how many people actually watch Nomadland, right? So you're able to get the soft power win there, but then also these Marvel movies, which the Chinese audience unironically loves. It's really double angled there. Sagar, but yeah, please go on.
Yeah. By the way, shout out to Nomadland. Incredible movie.
Fantastic.
So good. Eternals, not so much. I still watch it though. But let's talk about this story, because this is fascinating to me. As when Marshall and I were discussing it, it's kind of the state of American manufacturing, which is that the Chinese are like, hey, regulatory arbitrage, come on over, you know, come on in. We got the cheap labor. We'll give you guys all the subsidies in the world, everything that you need. And then the entire time that they're there, they're observing. They're like, oh, that's how you do this. Let's build the supply chain. So we American companies go over, we build up a huge domestic supply chain in China. We build up all of this domestic talent. We basically show them how to do everything. And then lo and behold, slowly beginning around 2013. And so these manufacturers start to get their IP stolen. They get kicked out. Their licenses get revoked. And then you basically find a situation where American manufacturing industry gets screwed. The Chinese have a thriving domestic market. So we're not there yet with the Chinese film industry, but what does that look like? Like, what have they learned from America? What have they observed? And what are they now doing domestically? And what are they going to try and do 5 years from now? Are they going to try, in other words, usurp Hollywood? Or are they going to try and just concentrate on their own borders? What do you think, Eric?
Who's they in this case? Right. So, like, who's they? And then Sagar's point there.
Well, great point. They is the party, and I think your point is well made. And I thought a lot about this when I was setting out to write this book, because there are a lot of parallels between the experience of traditional manufacturing companies and the studios. And what I would add to your question is that not just are Chinese officials often observing how the work is done, but sometimes they are requiring a technology transfer for market access.
Right.
And so I one question I had when I set out to write this was, what does it look like when technology transfer is not airplane blueprints or semiconductors, but storytelling? And because the same kind of transfer was happening, and it happened in a couple different ways, one of which was they would just hire talent. I mean, you mentioned the Russo brothers, who are known for these Marvel epics. They helped the director of Wolf Warrior 2 with things like, you know, here's a good fight choreographer for you to hire. Here's a good sound mixer. And it's those kinds of things that, you know, you add up enough of them, and if they're done well, it can really lift a film. You know, we've all seen movies with crappy special effects and things, and you can just sort of see right through it. But if you can kind of help those things on the edges, it can do a lot. And then the more interesting thing, and I think the more, you know, more ineffable thing is, like, how do you sort of win hearts and minds? And that is a gap that China is really trying to close in countries around the world. And so I talked to this writer who told me this fascinating story. His name's Bruce Feirstein. And he wrote a couple James Bond movies, and then he was hired to go and work on a Chinese drama. And he was talking to this actor who had a scene where he was going to sort of have a little bit of a flirtation with a maid in the film. And the actor was really huffy and said, you know, a character of my standing would never have a dalliance with a maid, would never flirt with a maid. And Bruce had to explain to him that the maid was the audience surrogate, that the maid was all the women and men in the audience who wanted to flirt with the lead actor, and explained that, you know, we go to the movies for other things. We go to the movies not to see a reflection of the world, but to see an aspiration of the world. And so that really I would define as kind of a technology transfer of sorts. Now, where Hollywood tripped up is that we had a real collision of short-term thinking versus long-term thinking, where, especially because the studios today are parts of these publicly traded conglomerates, it's really more than ever about winning the quarter. And China, a place where people very casually talk about 5,000 years of history, was able to think much longer term. And what I think we're seeing now is a buildup of the Chinese film industry that will try to mount a competition to Hollywood, but also, like a lot of things in Xi Jinping's China, is also going to be about servicing China and Chinese people. So we're seeing, I think in 5 years, there's actually, because it's China, there's a 5-year plan. And in the 5-year plan is this effort to become a stronger, the word they often use is strong film power, which will mean more propaganda films, more films extolling China, more films that are going to make sure that they align with certain Chinese priorities. So like, for example, like a very quick way to accrue political capital if you are a Chinese producer is to make a movie and somehow connect it to the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yep.
That's like a fantastic way to curry a little bit of favor. And I think we'll be seeing more and more of that.
So that's what I wanted to dig in a little bit more on, that, which is that, do they have aspirations to be a cultural global hegemon the way that the United States is? Or, I mean, is that in the 5 to 25 year plan, or is it much more just, hey, we're locking, you know, they have the Chinese firewall already on the internet. They want to control everything within their own borders. Now they have the capability to make a Wolf Warrior 2, to make a, what is it? The Battle of Chosin. I forget what it's called.
Chongqing. It's the
huge, Lake Chongqing.
Korean War epic. It was the biggest grossing movie of last year, I believe.
Which was the biggest grossing movie of the year. Three COVID Body edition. Problem was a big cultural export for them. Do they want more Three Body Problems? In essence, like, what is the goal of the CCP there?
I think recently we've seen more of an internal goal become more the priority, but I don't think they're going to stop trying to export around the world. I mean, it's very interesting. Over the past year or so, we've seen a really cruel comparison emerge with Korea and Korea's success with Squid Game and K-pop and Parasite.
Yeah.
Those, I mean, Korea right now has exactly what Chinese leaders want.
Right. So hot right now. Yeah.
Very hot. Very hot right now. The key difference being China would never produce a Squid Game.
Yeah.
And China does have Chinese versions of K-pop, but every once in a while, a story will emerge of one of its singers falling into trouble and then having to release an anthem pledging allegiance to the party. I mean, there's this system in place that has made exporting difficult. But what is fascinating, and I think in Hollywood, I will often run into a kind of complacency, because executives here will say, you know, no one in America is going to go see a Chinese movie. Like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was 20 years ago, and there hasn't been anything before.
Well, and you cover this in the book. It's kind of a Taiwanese movie too.
Exactly.
Ang Lee's like Taiwanese. And funnily enough, the Chinese didn't even like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because all the things that were, and I'm just quoting you basically, that were novel for us were just basic kung fu movie tropes. It's just, it's very average and obvious. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, yeah, exactly. So, but I think that the dangerous complacency there is just forgetting that there's a bigger world out there, and that there are markets that I think will be more receptive to Chinese entertainment. I spend a lot of time in the book in Africa, where the Belt and Road Initiative has certainly just completely transformed so many countries there for better and worse. But there is a massive cultural soft power complement to all of the infrastructure, all of the loans. You know, I think those markets that already are very more accustomed than the US to receiving entertainment and importing entertainment might be where the audience is for Chinese blockbusters and Chinese soap operas and Chinese TV shows.
The thing that's interesting here, and you set this up well with this idea of in China, Jen, once again, this is part of what makes this so precarious, which is that it's not as if there's a direct memo saying this isn't okay, but they're the three G's, as you're right. So gore, ghosts, and gay people, basically these things that like China doesn't want in their movies as a general rule. And there are obviously exceptions, like the Korean War movie we just referenced is incredibly bloody. So it's not as if there's always this hard and set thing here, which people have to navigate. But by removing those three things, that seems like a total stamp on creativity and the process that actually leads to good movies. So when you're referencing the part where you're talking about Africa, it's talking about how, you know, Chinese telecom companies are delivering like cable satellite television to people. The part that I'm like, oh wow, that's a competition board for the US is the, oh, you're helping people get TV and you're helping people get basic infrastructure. I'm less concerned about the actual quality of the film product. And I hope I don't sound, I don't think this is just American chauvinism. I think there is something to open dynamic society, Sagar and I were talking about this, that creates good subversive movies. Not one like authoritarian, so like let's go into it right now. Like, we just ask you the question directly. Can authoritarian top-down societies produce good movies? Unclear.
Very, very unclear. I mean, I think that what often gets lost in this conversation is just how savvy audiences are and just how quickly they pick up the pandering shows and movies that feel like medicine. You know, it's very common to go to China and have people say like, oh, that was pretty good for a propaganda movie. I mean, you know, I think sometimes we can have these conversations as though people are just sort of like blindly ingesting these messages.
Yeah,
but no, it's very, I mean, it was very obvious when Hollywood was trying to pander to China, how insulting and
tell the Iron Man 3 story, please. Your teen.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So Iron Man 3, which came out, I think in 2012, 2013, 2013 was really like the fever dream of Hollywood going crazy for Chinese grosses, like trying to do anything they could to get them. And Iron Man 3 went so far as to film a scene where Iron Man has to be treated by a Chinese doctor and his, I think, assistant or nurse, using acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine. And they filmed the scene. It included all this Chinese product placement. Chinese milk was at one point in the scene.
This is very not Marvel. Like, that's not a thing they do generally.
No, not at all. And so, I mean, it was just very obvious, like this totally random insertion of the film into the film. And when the officials or the executives at Marvel saw this, they were like, no one's going to go for this. Like, let's only show it in the Chinese version. And they soon realized that is considered very insulting to Chinese authorities for two reasons. One is, I think they don't want to feel like they're getting a pandered or sort of like a B version of a film. But the other is that like, they're not requesting that scene or they're not working with the Hollywood studio on that scene because they want Chinese audiences to see it. They want audiences around the world to see China in a certain way. Yes. So like to make it only for China is like, just like, defeats the purpose. Like, yeah, you might be kind of cool and it might goose some ticket sales, but this is more about audiences in Canada or Paris or Tunisia having different ideas about China and the people who live there. And so, yeah, and you still see it now, like, and I actually think this book might ruin movie going for a lot of readers, because if you have those glasses on when you're going to see a film, you still will see Chinese product placement, references to China, scenes that don't need to take place in Shanghai, but somehow do. Like, you'll still see that time and time again as they try to gain an advantage in an increasingly competitive market.
So yeah, quick follow-up on this, Sagar. Yeah. So as you frame it, that was the version 1.0, very obvious. It isn't successful. What's version 2.0 look like? So like from 2014 to 2017, what does the more sophisticated, A, that could be used for global audiences, but also not insult the people who you're trying to pander to? What does that version look like?
I think the studios, I mean, there were a couple high profile examples, like again, another Marvel example was when they adapted Doctor Strange, having to take a character who in the comics had been, frankly, a rather stereotypical portrayal of a Tibetan monk, and instead cast Tilda Swinton as kind of a Celtic analog. That was just a very obvious way to avoid having to deal with any Tibet issues. So we still see examples like that. But
sorry to interrupt, but like, this is the problem. Like, there's incredible sidebars that we have to hit. What is so great about the Tilda sub-in was this was a huge controversy because it was framed as Marvel is racist. They are taking this, like, obviously no one was defending the portrayal. I think it was like a Fu Manchu, like,
very
mustache.
Fu Manchu,
Like, no one was asking for the 1930s version of the character, but people were kind of like, because I remember just seeing this organically, like, wait, like, why did you make an Asian character in a series where there weren't, this is pre-Doctor Strange, this is pre-Shang-Chi, like, there were no Asian, this is pre-Eternals, there were no Asian characters, really. Why did you take one of the first biggest ones and make them Celtic? But what people didn't know is this wasn't, like, white normative execs being like, let's get our Irish, you know, heritage in. It was this weird thing. So it's so fascinating.
It just so happened that, yeah, like the Asian portrayal that could have been brought to screen was an ethnicity that, like, has gotten Hollywood into all sorts of trouble in the past, and that they just avoid at any cost. So you had high profile examples like that, but I have to say, like, really what started to work, I'd say, at the apex of the China-Hollywood relationship around 2016, 2017, was big Hollywood movies that didn't try to pander, but were instead just like the best kind of global blockbuster with the best special effects. Like, no other country on earth is making Avengers Endgame. No other country on earth is making the Fast and Furious 7. And, like, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing. I don't know.
Stick with Avengers.
Yeah. We are still the only market that's making those kinds of, like, global products on screen.
Yeah.
And they were doing really, really well in China. And they were, in some cases, sending back to the studios a net of like $100 million. And the other thing about the China market that's kind of unique is that it's a very cheap market. Like, you don't have a lot of time to market a movie. Even if you do, you're not taking out like billboards and TV commercials that often cost a lot of money. So when you get a movie released, it's not like there's a lot of expenses. So, like, a lot of it is just net profit, which makes it, you know, even more appealing.
So let's talk a little bit about even before that, because I think that the story up until then is really interesting. And I like some of the anecdotes are from 1997, how it was the most important year in terms of Hollywood, China, and all of that. Begins with 7 years, no, what is it? Red Corner, 7 Years of Tibet, and Kundun. Explain it to the audience who may not have lived through that. By the way, I watched 7 Years of Tibet, and I still... like, it was fine. It was a fine movie. Still the worst German accent.
I quite liked it.
Really? I'm surprised. It's a good story. The book is actually great. But what a horrible German accent. Anyway,
we're attacking Brad Pitt here. You may have seen his beautiful face on your streaming. So I can see because like, there's a very nice picture of him on the streaming service.
Yeah,
but
no,
sorry,
he
go
looked,
on.
He looked good in it.
Honestly, like, that is like peak movie star moment. Right. Yes, the hair, everything. I mean, really, just like. And actually, it's funny. You're reminding me that when I was calling around about that movie, 7 Years in Tibet. One producer who clearly hadn't thought about it since it came out had been like, I was like, why didn't it do well at the box office? And his explanation was that Brad Pitt was too blonde.
He's very blonde.
He is super blonde. It looks like it's odd.
Well, why does he look Aryan? Just like,
no, I know.
Where is he getting that coloring done during his 7 years in Tibet? it's almost unbelievable, but like, in 1 year, you had 3 movies come out that all pissed off China. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just like a record we'll never hit again. But it really was a formative year because it is essentially the year that taught all of Hollywood some of the rules they'd have to play by. The one thing to remember, so back in 1994 was whenever Hollywood movies first started going into China. The first one was The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. Fantastic movie.
Yeah, awesome.
After that, a handful of movies would get in every year, but it was really an afterthought. I mean, there were hardly any screens. I mean, the country's sort of mass urbanization campaign had started, but not really taken off. So like, we're not even talking about people paying like, you know, less than $1 a ticket. So no Hollywood executives thinking they're gonna get rich off of China. And therefore, no Hollywood executive is worried about pissing them off. And so you have 3 movies come out, 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, which is a story about like a young Dalai Lama. You have Kundun by Martin Scorsese, also about a young Dalai Lama. And then you have Red Corner with Richard Gere, which is about an American executive who's kind of caught up in China's Kafka-esque legal system. And it's really a horribly critical portrayal of China's sort of how China rules. Mm-hmm. All 3 movies are still in production or not out yet when China makes it very clear that they do not approve of this. And each studio that releases each film is banned in the market. So 7 Years in Tibet is released by Sony. Kundun is released by Disney. And Red Corner is released by MGM. And each of them have, and this is another sort of sign of things to come, each of them have much larger interests in the country beyond just putting out movies. And so the executives are caught in a tough spot. Like, let's take Kundun for an example. Kundun was flagged to Disney executives the day it started shooting. There was a call made to the offices in Burbank saying, we know you're making this movie and we don't like it. And so all of the conversations we're having about letting your TV channel into our country, the conversations we're having about your theme park, the conversations we're having about toys, this is Disney. Yeah. Like all of those conversations are now jeopardized because of the release of this film that hasn't even come out yet. And so Disney's in a tough spot because here on one hand, you could kill the film and piss off Martin Scorsese and be seen as sort of censoring free speech. I mean, you know, Hollywood would rally against that, or you can jeopardize your chances in a market that in 1997 is not making you a lot of money, but clearly will 10 or 15 years from now. And so each of the studios found themselves in those situations and they took different routes toward trying to straddle both lines. With Disney, they luckily had Henry Kissinger on retainer, and Henry Kissinger and an executive from Burbank went to the Chinese embassy in DC, explained the situation, saying to them, you know, look, if we kill this film, it's not good for either of us. So they released Kundun, but they essentially buried it. They tried to make sure.
No one's heard of Kundun ever. No one's ever heard of this movie.
And I actually, you know, what's interesting is like, so they rather successfully buried it. The movie came out, hardly anyone saw it. And then several months later, there was this sort of fresh surge of anxiety at Disney because they were worried it was going to be nominated for an Oscar. And they're like, oh shit, this is going to bring it all back again. And it got nominated for some, but it didn't get any big awards. So they were in the clear. But for a while, Brad Pitt, blonde Brad Pitt, he was banned in the in the country. And even years later, his movies seem to have a harder time than others getting into the country. So it taught Hollywood several lessons. One of which is, if you release a movie that the Chinese authorities do not like, it's not going to just jeopardize your movie studio. It could jeopardize the entire parent company.
Yes.
And then the other lesson is just like the very long memories that the Chinese authorities have, where anyone associated with those films had to go years before they could be back in the party's good graces. And in the case of someone like Richard Gere, who was so vocally anti-China and so vocally pro-Tibet, his career has never really fully recovered.
I'm really depressed that you mentioned Richard Gere, because I was going to make a Darth Plagueis the Wise joke. Tell the tragic tale of Richard Gere, the principled but not so wise. It's kind of funny because when you hear this, you're like, yeah, Richard Gere is a good actor. He's in these iconic movies in the 80s. He's doing these things in the 90s. And then you're like, wait a second. You're right. I did just last see him in this random Redbox dog movie, which looked nice enough. But this isn't like what happened. This is important because it actually shows that there were real consequences here. And this is actually, and people are explicit about like, oh, yeah, that's what happened to him. So please tell more about Richard Gere.
You're right. Back in the 80s, when we were growing up, he was like the star of Pretty Woman and An Officer and a Gentleman. I think he was people's sexiest man alive, maybe more than once. A huge actor. In the early 90s is when he started to really speak out about Tibet, even at one point interrupting the Oscars to give a little speech about it. So really ahead of his time there as well, in terms of using the Oscar podium as a bit of a political soapbox. And so then he makes this movie Red Corner. I mean, going back, it really is striking how vocal he was. I mean, at the time that Red Corner was coming out in 97, there was a state visit from China to the Clinton White House. And even during that visit, he was staging kind of protests around that visit, really being quite vocal. And for a while, his career kept going. He was in Chicago. He was still doing bigger movies. But as China's box office became more and more important to the studios, he became more and more radioactive. Mm-hmm. And the last major studio film he was in was called Knights in Rodanthe. It's a romance he was in with Diane Lane in 2009.
That's wild. That was so long ago.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And certainly in Hollywood years. And I would ask people about this, and I would say, you know, is it because of China that he's not getting bigger parts? And some, you know, because Hollywood's full of such nice guys, some of them would say, you know, well, Richard Gere's always been difficult to work with. No one wants to hire him. Okay. Other people said he's always been getting John Travolta's hand-me-downs anyway. So
I think he is superior to John Travolta, especially post-1990s. I will speak up for him there.
I would stand for him.
I appreciate that. I'm sure he does too. Yeah. But that I ended up talking to people who were in charge of such things like casting, and they would say, look, here's like, it makes sense. Think of the risk profile, right? Like if you're casting a role for Richard Gere these days, chances are it's a supporting part. I mean, if you look at it, sort of the trajectory of his contemporaries like Michael Douglas, they're getting parts in Ant-Man as is he the
William
dad?
Defoe too. There's a bunch Willem of these guys.
Willem Dafoe. Yeah. There's kind of a sweet spot for these sort of elder statesmen of the industry.
But you're still keeping it tight. That's the key thing. I always think this. They're like, you're in your 60s, but you still look good. Like that's Willem Dafoe's doing his own stunts as Spider-Man. Like that's the key. And Richard Gere could have done that. Like that's the key thing.
Exactly. And I talked to one casting executive at Warner Brothers who said, look, the rule always became, if you can get someone else, get someone else. You know, if we desperately need Richard Gere for this part, let's have a conversation. But otherwise, we can go to any other name on the list. Now, to his, to his point, Richard Gere has spoken about this and has said that he has enjoyed making these smaller, frankly, in his view, more interesting independent films. And he's continued to really be quite a public advocate for Tibet. He just, I think, last year or in 2020 was testifying before Congress on various issues. So it has, it seems like it has not been the case with, as we have seen with other actors, where he's been sort of rushing to rectify this situation.
Yeah. And that, hopefully he made enough money in the 80s.
And that, and that's been, I think, yeah, we're not claiming that Richard Gere is in the poorhouse, but I think the fact that he is just the prime example, given the incentives, is what's really telling here. So follow-up question that came from your reference to the 1990s, how ownership structures really dictated this. So it's like you said, you've got Disney. Film is not the leading edge here. It's the parks. It's getting the Disney Channel. It's those different parts. Another company that owns something is Sony. So Sony, they don't sell a lot of tickets in China, but they import a lot of electronics. So like that's a major thing. You referenced them taking their names off of controversial films. As studios like MGM, for example, go through difficulty as Hollywood's getting upended right now, or as they are possibly acquired by tech companies, how do you see the fact that many of the tech companies that don't have relationships with China for a variety of reasons, how does that impact how this market could play out? Because a good example of this is, as you've pointed out, streaming services aren't available in China. These are available on Tencent and the other two services. Therefore, you will find much more controversial fare on, you know, the where did I actually see 7 years in Tibet? It was on Netflix for a while there. So how does the possibility of tech coming in and acquiring studios for IP purposes shift maybe the incentives here?
Yeah, it depends on the tech company. Apple is not going to make anything that's going to alienate China. Obviously, massive holdings there. Netflix is the very interesting case because Netflix tried very hard to get into China. The executives there would met with officials. I think it was a years-long campaign to try and get access to the market. And I think it remains one of maybe two or three countries where it doesn't operate. I mean, North Korea is one of them. Syria, I think, is another.
August company there.
I mean, it is a real, it's like, I mean, if you look at the Netflix map, it is like a big gaping hole. But China,
Is this why they made that really bad Marco Polo Game of Thrones knockoff? Was that an attempt to get into the Chinese market?
It's a great question. I don't know. I mean, because they've identified a Chinese market. It's just not in China. So a lot of these blockbusters, the streaming rights are purchased by Netflix for the, as you said, the Chinese diaspora community to watch. But we have seen a little bit more freedom, and which is, I mean, it's ironic because Netflix has censored content for countries it is operating in, like Saudi Arabia and Hassan Minhaj show. But China, and the fact that it's pretty clear that they're not going to get in, has given it a little bit of freedom.
It's just total. There's no, it's, see,
it's like what happened to Facebook.
The wiggle, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Because what's so helpful here is, and what you get at here is, it's the wiggle room where all the danger happens. It's the, well, maybe this, that, but if it's just this direct, it goes there. Sagar, to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we are a public policy show, so be remiss if we didn't ask you about this. Where does public policy play a role in this? I can tell you, Eric, I've personally asked this to very senior leaders. I was like, what are you doing about this? But you write in the book the role that our current sitting president actually played in this. So A, can you tell the story? And B, what public policy choices do we face, if any, in the future that could dictate the future of the U.S. film industry in China?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'll start with the story of Biden and Xi in 2012. In 2012, I'd say the market was still a bundle of projections, but there were some really clear signs that this was going to be massive. One of which was the release of Avatar a few years prior, which was this massive blockbuster in China, in part because it was the first 3D movie that a lot of Chinese moviegoers had gone to see. So Hollywood successfully lobbied for then Vice President Biden and some other officials to renegotiate what they call the quota agreement. So the quota agreement between the US and China is basically the terms of how many Hollywood movies or how many foreign films are we going to allow in every year, and how much money are you going to get out of the ticket sales. And before the quota agreement, it was really just usually around a dozen a year. And I think Hollywood got around like 12%, 14% of ticket sales. And in 2012, Vice President Biden, on a meeting, when he was meeting with Xi Jinping, who was visiting the US as sort of the heir apparent of the CCP, met with him, and they successfully negotiated to expand the quota to 34 films and 25% of ticket sales. So this really meant that if of the then six major Hollywood studios, pretty much all their major films could feasibly get into China. Mm-hmm. And it just significantly expanded the market access. And part of it was negotiated at a Lakers game that the two men attended together. And this is also, it's worth pointing out, this is also a moment, maybe appears a little naive in retrospect, where Xi Jinping was seen as a potential reformer. Mm-hmm. And a leader who, once named president and head of the party, might bring in some more democratic reforms.
And this is a great example of that hypothetically.
Exactly.
It wasn't a crazy case at the time. I mean, you know, his dad was imprisoned or whatever during the Cultural Revolution. He spent a lot of time here. Yeah. He was friends with Terry Branstad, the Iowa governor. Like, you know, it wasn't nuts in order to think that. I mean, it was naive, like you said. But I think that the important question then is what about now? So Biden brokers this deal where, you know, ironically backfires and makes it so that Hollywood becomes more reliant on China. They get to increase their box office take. So right now in 2022, does President Biden, the Biden administration, face any like ability to impact the situation at all? Because I'm alluding to the Pompeo conversation I had. He's basically like, look, there's nothing I can do about it.
I don't think it's a top priority. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think for a long time, the studios in the MPAA, especially during the Trump administration, were really just trying to duck and cover. They did not want the movies to be drawn into the larger trade dispute. And now there's real frustration that China doesn't even seem to be following the terms that Biden negotiated in 2012, that the quota agreement has just been essentially thrown out the window. But it's really tricky to say like what exactly policymakers should do, because one thing that I really wanted to interrogate in the book was why do we think of Hollywood as this American industry? And I think it's because its history has, there have been these moments throughout American history, especially in the past 100 years or so, when Hollywood has been conscripted to do its part on the behalf of America. Whenever
World War II,
Vietnam. World War II is the most prominent example of directors like Frank Capra going and filming battle scenes and making these very raw patriotic films to engender support for the war. But even before that, whenever the MPAA was first founded, its founder described it as an adjunct of the State Department. Hmm. And really using language that we now hear from Chinese officials, said, we will use the movies to spread American ideals around the world. And so there's always been this sense that Hollywood should do America's bidding when called to. But when you talk to Hollywood executives, they don't really think of themselves as running American companies. They think of them, they might be based in America, but they're really distributing and putting out global products. It was described to me at one point as, you know, I think what would have been like the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie. I don't know when that came out. Probably early 2002.
2000.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
I remember because they had to edit out the Twin Towers. That's the
correct. Oh,
right. Yeah, because there was a scene of him swinging down and they had to be edited out. So that's why 2002.
God. It's a great point. I do remember that. This studio executive was explaining to me how I think it was the poster for that movie had the American flag on it, because it was a Spider-Man movie. It wasn't like prominent, but it had an American flag on it. And by the time I think they got to the Andrew Garfield iteration, there was no flag on a poster anywhere. Not because it wasn't an American movie, people knew it was made in America, but because it was servicing a global audience And you didn't want to alienate any audience by them thinking it was too associated with America. So when you're putting out these films that star American actors and largely take place in America, but are making 70% of their money outside of America, it's hard to really feel like I remember after 9/11, I was told there was an effort to try and enlist Hollywood to maybe make some movies that would help either, you know, bring audiences in the Middle East to America's side or something. And a lot of the executives looked at the officials and were like, that's not my job. It's just not what I do.
Also,
and
probably
I
the correct decision, frankly.
Well, even, I mean, yeah, those probably might be, some pretty painful
World War
movies.
II, but, yeah, Iraq War. I'm like, yeah,
I'm with Hollywood, which is a very rare thing.
Probably dodged a bullet there. You're right. But that sort of sense of Hollywood being threaded to America's mission has really, you don't hear anyone out here talking in those terms. And so a lot of the policy that's been sort of suggested, I mean, there's been very, very little, despite there being quite a bit of bipartisan outrage every time a John Cena apologizes. There's been very little I've seen that seems like a plausible policy answer to this influence.
It's interesting while you're talking, you referenced something much earlier, and this is what my last question to you, which is that should we not then consider art intellectual property? I mean, I very clearly see a world, the Russo brothers being an example. I mean, we have something called the Export Control Act right now. You're not allowed to do business with Chinese companies if you work in the semiconductor industry. You're not allowed to do business with specifically state designated entities in a variety of different things, which are not even in the defense industry, but are tangential to the defense supply chain. And I'm wondering, just spitballing here, should that maybe not apply to our movie industry, specifically to the, you know, the intellectual know-how and the stuff, like you're saying? I mean, look, you know, my parents are Indian. I've watched Bollywood movies evolve over the last 20 years. It's been insane. I mean, they used to be horrible. You watch a Bollywood movie now, you're like, oh, it's not quite there yet, but it's pretty good. It's like you said, which is that having that expertise and the know-how, that can rank a movie up dramatically. And if we then recognize these movies, as the Chinese quite clearly do, as explicit instruments of state power, we're not making Hollywood do anything, but we're saying like, hey, we're not going to let you build a propaganda arm out there. A, how do you think that would be received? B, is that plausible? What do you think?
It's a fascinating question. Yeah. And I think we're getting to a point where the movies are being seen as you're describing them, right? As these kind of hearts and minds influencers. It's interesting. I mean, not being able to transfer filmmaking skill, I don't see that being very plausible, because I mean, we're still talking about like rather like kind of like one-off agreements.
Sure.
I think it would be one thing if a Chinese real estate company tried to buy an American theater chain, as they did in 2012 when Wanda bought AMC.
Yep.
I think that deal would be far more scrutinized, and there would be far more questions raised about what kind of know-how the American company was handing over. Same goes for any Chinese takeover of an American studio. I think if a Chinese company tried to buy Paramount tomorrow, I don't think that deal would go through. And I think that, yeah, I think it would be a very different conversation than the last time a Chinese company almost bought Paramount. But in terms of the technology transfer, that is a lot trickier to clamp down on whenever it's like, hey, I'm an out of work stunt choreographer. I guess I'll just take a gig in China. I mean, because in some ways, the Chinese market has become what the straight to video market used to be. It's been a place for C or D list out of work directors, writers, producers, crew members to go to when they can't find work here in the States. I say in the book, you know, like the directors that we're sending over to teach American movie making are not exactly who you would appoint as ambassadors of American movie making. The guy I spent the most time with is a director named Rennie Harlan, who made movies in the 80s like Die Hard 2 and Cliffhanger, and then made what was at the time the record-setting bomb Cutthroat Island. And after that, he really found a hard time working. Lo and behold, he, for the past 6 years, has been on China's A-list. They love him. Wow. They can't get enough of Rennie Harlan. Good and so he's over there making movies and showing them how to make action movies and how to direct action movies. And look, I mean, he's making some movies that certainly make the state look good. He's not going over and saying, here's how to make a far better propaganda picture.
Right.
So I think where we'll see the scrutiny that you're describing is going to be more on a deal level than a sort of trying to cut back on this sort of more people to people connection.
Sure.
That's a great way of summing up, because it seems that the dichotomy that we didn't have in 2012 was the difference between business and culture. Culture is how you do something. It's practices, but there's also, wait, like, why we should maybe be reticent of letting a studio get acquired. So last two questions here. Question number one, because it's actually something I didn't know, but is very important. We've talked about Wolf Warrior 2, very successful movie, huge movie, but this is where how complicated this gets fascinating. There has not been a Wolf Warrior 3. Why hasn't there been a Wolf Warrior 3? Because you're talking about how they're building this domestic market. We're referencing the fact that they really like these 1980s action movies. Like, if you think of it, like, in terms of why are these directors succeeding? It's because of the world that they grew up in is much more like the world of China now. Why have we not seen a sequel to this huge movie? And this relates to the geopolitics thing. And then the second and final question here is, it seems like this is really just like the reason why this story resonates to people outside of film and Hollywood, like, obviously the three of us like this, is this idea that, look, after World War II, we had no economic competition and our manufacturers and our automobile industries, like, we could just dominate for 20 and 30 years. Then the Japanese went on board, Germany came back, China. It seems like today we had this like 70, 80 year period where the Soviets literally chose not to compete with us. The Chinese chose not to compete with us. The Japanese, like, kind of competed, but like not, actually, they kind of bought everything. So that's a little more complicated. But it seems like we're just, these dynamics around Sagar saying like, oh, like, people helping other industries, I'm not pushing against your position. Like, this is us trying to figure out what it's like to live in a world where there's actual competition. And it's hard to understand that. So I guess you take this in reverse order. So what are the implications for Hollywood's future in a world where there's global competition? The big question. Then two, like, why isn't there a sequel to Wolf Warrior 3?
So yeah, I'll tackle the sequel question first. So I mean, honestly, it's like, if a movie came out in Hollywood with Wolf Warrior 2's box office, there would have been a sequel in production like before the first weekend of grosses were even counted. I mean, it would have just been franchise. There would have been a theme park ride. I mean, it would have been like, you know, off and running. In China, though, as you know, there's always this sort of like barometer at work of like, how aggressive do we want to be? And Wolf Warrior 2, which I encourage everyone to watch if they haven't seen it, is this sort of fascinating, as you said, it's like China's version of Rambo. This fascinating look at Chinese heroism and often like just like American either like evil or just like chauvinism. Idiocy. Yeah, I mean, just, like, yeah. Just like, I mean, like, there's this moment where like the UN shows up to help and their helicopter crashes. I mean, it's just like, it is not a subtle film. But when it came out, there were some parts of the party apparatus that thought, this is going too far. This is us pounding our chest a little too hard. And Wolf Warrior 3, which in the Chinese system has to be approved for production, has never gone forward. Instead, the actor and director who was made very famous by Wolf Warrior 2, Wu Jing, he has been cast and produced and directed a lot of really just sort of straight state-sanctioned propaganda films. Mm-hmm. So, kind of another example, frankly, of China maybe getting in the party maybe getting in its own way. Here you have Wolf Warrior 2, which is considered like a good propaganda film. I call it like the pill in the pill is in the peanut butter, right? Mm-hmm. Like people enjoy watching it and they're getting a pro-China message. And instead he sort of had to shift toward these more state-sanctioned, frankly, medicinal films that the Chinese authorities would rather he make. Because there's even been speculation that one reason Wolf Warrior 2 did not result in a Wolf Warrior 3 is because China doesn't like the idea of the Rambo template. Like it's not the Chinese way for there to be sort of a lone wolf who's breaking off. I mean, think about how many Hollywood movies could never get made if we had to follow that rule, right? It's literally every film is like the cop that like has to avenge the murder, right? because has to say screw you to the bosses and go his own way.
Internal Affairs is the hero in all the Chinese version of those movies.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's as one person I spoke to in China put it, in China right now, there's an agreement that China should appear strong. There's just disagreement about how. And so that's why we haven't seen a Wolf Warrior 3. But then remind me
the last disastrously way too long question. Basically, the question is this. It seems like China. Okay, this is good. This is a reworded version. There's a good article in the Ankler that Sagar and I referenced, and one of the comments pointed out that it seems clearer now more than ever that no one in Hollywood basically knows what the next 10 to 15 years look like. And what China was so useful for the past 10 years as the internet happens and there's streaming services, is the answer was China. Go to China. That was just the obvious deus ex machina option here. So in a world where there's more competition, it doesn't seem like there's any answer right now. Like, so I'm not asking. So this isn't a prediction question because those are lame. Just what are the people you're talking to? I think at the end of your interview in your interview with Matthew Bellini, you were like, yeah, I wouldn't want to be a Hollywood executive right now. So just channel their reaction to everything we're talking about, and then we'll close up.
Yeah, I think it's going to force a real consideration of like how the studio economics work right now, because when China is in play, it allows you to spend a lot more money, because if you're greenlighting a movie and you're saying, okay, this movie's going to cost X amount of money, but we're expecting $250 million in grosses out of China. Like that so on a very like sort of root level, it affects how studio accounting is done and how they decide how many kinds of movies to make and what kinds of movies to make and how much to spend on them. But the other kind of variant here, if I can use that word in any other kind of context, is that like streaming is throwing all of this into disarray right now as well, because streaming is a strategy that every major studio is pursuing. Wall Street loves it, and it's giving them these incredible stock valuations. And it's a strategy that relies less and less on China. So it does seem like in some ways, China shutting out Hollywood is hastening Hollywood's evolution to kind of a post-theatrical landscape.
That is so interesting. God,
which is fascinating. I'm thinking out loud here, and that raises real questions about whether or not China is therefore hastening a decline in Hollywood influence. Because one issue that a lot of people in Hollywood will bring up when it comes to streaming is it doesn't allow you to have the global sensation that, like, we will never have another Star Wars. We will never have, we'll see if we have another Avatar, because we're going to get like 17 more. But I think like there's this idea that kind of like monomythic culture can't really exist in a post-theatrical world, that streaming by virtue of its model is just too fragmented and bifurcated for that to work. But it just so happens that the studios today can't ignore it, because Wall Street is just valuing it at such higher multiples than it ever will again, the theatrical market.
Okay, you're gonna have to come back, because I could literally do a whole hour on that. That is so interesting to me, which is that bundle economics might actually save us from like the Disney bundle stock multiple that their stock has received has made it so that what HBO and all of these other major holding companies have an incentive then to lean more into that direction, which in my opinion is actually better for high quality content spread out over. And oh man, this is going to be, that's going to be a good episode. So promise me that you'll come back. Everybody go buy this book. We're going to have a link down in the description for everybody to go and purchase it. This has been one of my favorite interviews that we've done. And yeah, just thank you so much, Eric, for coming on. It's been amazing talking to you.
Hey, thank you. This was really fun.
Absolutely. All right, thanks.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.